You are joined by myself, Donny, Antoinette, and Ibby. Welcome to the Identity Talk.
Woo-hoo!
When we discuss gender expression, Ant, would you care to tell us what we mean by that?
Oh yeah. So your gender expression is essentially how you present yourself to the world. It's everything. It's your mannerisms. It's the way you dress. It's the way you speak. It's the way you behave. And there are just quick breakdown. There are two models of gender, essentially. There's the essentialist model, which is pioneered by Rigoret and people, which is that gender is something that we have. It's our essence, you know, it's something intrinsic. Yeah. And then there's the model pioneered by Judith Butler, which is the performative model. So the way that I tend to remember it is a rhyme taught to me by my friend Sumner, and it goes, "Roses are red, gender is performative, modern society is heteronormative."
I love that. I think that's fantastic. Great.
But yeah, essentially, your gender expression is just how you present to people. Yeah.
So it's the way in which a person acts to communicate gender within a given culture.
Totally not reading that off the screen. But yeah, it's really interesting because it is an extremely social construct. Like, I actually saw a piece of, I think it was an article, where there was suggestions that babies can even begin responding to gender constructs when they're even 3 or 4 months old based on the pitch of their cries. And I think that's really interesting. But yeah, gender is a construct, guys. That's the main nugget.
I think that's a really important thing to take away from this, because I know, and I will frankly admit that I'm speaking very much from my experiences growing up in a different culture and a different country. Mm-hmm. But I do know that there is often the conflation between gender and sex. And I think that's something that's really important to highlight, where a lot of people continue, and this is in many parts of the world, including, as we mentioned last week, the horrendous trans laws in North Carolina.
Yes.
One of the things that underlines discrimination, whether it's legal or just simple social stigma, regarding things like gender identity and gender expression, is the conflation between biological and physiological sex, mm-hmm, with what gender is. And I think it's really important to highlight that they are two very different things.
And they don't always correlate.
They absolutely do not.
Yeah, like, as a queer individual, it's really difficult to consider even gender and sex as the same thing, because they're just, you know, one of them is something that you're born with, and another one is something that you develop. And as a queer person, it's just difficult to see them placed together, because they're so different and nuanced. And
absolutely.
You have to be really sensitive when talking about these things as well. But dialogue is so important.
Yes, definitely. And also, another thing is, though you may identify with, you know, they, them, she, her, or him and he, you don't, gender expression, so there's a difference also. You can express yourself in kind of however way you want, in essence. I don't know if it's so much a fashion statement, but we will be talking about that later on.
Absolutely.
Or it's more what you feel. I mean, I think the way you dress and the way you kind of present yourself to others is actually quite important when we're discussing your identity and who you are. So that's something we'll go into in the third segment. So also, there is a difference between your sexual orientation and romantic orientation. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that we wanted to touch upon, because, you know, because obviously many of us do conflate, you know, biological sex with gender, because it becomes so ingrained within us that, you know, you're born with this set of genitalia, you will perform these actions and behave in these ways. And also, yeah, so we're going to now distinguish between romantic attraction and sexual attraction.
Well, one of them is what you do in the bedroom, and the other one is choosing who you do it with and why. So
that's a lovely way of putting it. That is genuinely, like, a fantastic way of putting it.
Not even in the bedroom. I mean, do whatever you want. But, yeah, sorry, too loud. But,
that's fine.
But, yeah, essentially, your romantic life is very different. It's who you connect with, you know, on a mental level, who you vibe with, whether there's chemistry, and your sex life is your sex life.
Yes, so it's the physical side. So romance, you know, everyone knows that love is abstract. It's not a, yes, it's an abstract entity. Whereas, you know, the physical side, you know, you gotta know what you like.
I also think that it's, on the topic of having raised sexuality, I also think it's really important to point out to a lot of people that sexuality and gender are
two separate things. Yeah.
Well, the reason I point this out is because a lot of times, and I will preface this by saying to any listener who might identify with this situation, I am sharing this as a hypothetical. My apologies if it is something that comes across as being personal. But you can, you know, there are times where certain aspects of a queer individual's identity can be erased or ignored. For instance, if an individual is, you know, their gender is female, and they're open about being trans female, and they are then attracted to a man, that means they are a heterosexual trans female. That does not, their pre-transition identity, if it is something you may be privy to, has no bearing on what their sexuality is. If they identify as female, their sexuality is then informed by that gender identity and that expression. So I think that's really important to point out.
Yeah, that's a really, really important topic. I'm so glad that you raised that, because for a lot of trans people, it's not safe to express themselves fully as trans. So if you're stealth and you're operating on, you know, if you're presenting yourself as a particular gender, so in a masculine way, but you identify as feminine, if you are in a relationship with someone who also identifies as a woman, you are a lesbian, because you obviously, again, this is hypothetical, identify as whatever you want, but it is informed by the way that you identify, not by how you present yourself.
Absolutely.
I would argue. And yeah, that was be that.
I just think that it's something that needed to be brought up, because, and we will be touching on this later on, as Donnie has said, you know, when we talk about things like clothing and fashion and trends,
yes,
is there is an ingrained gut reaction that we've been programmed to kind of judge or make assumptions based on how someone presents and how someone projects. And a lot of these discussions, particularly particularly for individuals who are just coming to terms with it, or as Ant said, individuals who, for a variety of reasons, including personal safety, aren't out, at least not in a very, very public way. These are very personal things to talk about, but it's important to make sure that we do not make assumptions.
So, would you care to share, what is your definition? What is a social norm, essentially? What is a social norm?
Bloody hell, here we go.
Straight into the deep end.
Ibby, go for it.
Well, my understanding of the social, of a definition of a social norm, and before I say it, share it, I will put the other caveat of I'm a politics student, so everything I say is horrendously politically charged. My understanding of what a social norm is from a very, very basic definition of it, is just anything that falls into the accepted practices. Mm-hmm. So you know, the social norm of freedom of speech as a social norm, for instance. And I say that because that's something that's been kind of in the news a lot lately, and it's been very relevant to us as students. So the idea that you can have a platform for free speech is now regarded as a social norm, because it's something that has evolved into being acceptable across society. Compare that to what the social norm regarding free speech was hundreds of years ago, and there were certain groups that weren't allowed to have free speech. There were disenfranchised groups, and the social norm at the time was not to question this. So mm-hmm. I'm just using this as an example. There are many others, but you know, and we will obviously be going into discussions of social norms regarding gender and sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in a nutshell, that's what a social norm is: something that has been socially acceptable into practice.
Yeah. There is a... if that's okay, I'm going to take the flip side to that and go venture into the realm of the Q, or the queer, which is, by definition, anything that is not the norm. So it's things that people might consider, like, deviant or unusual. So...
Or unacceptable. If we're talking about norms that are practiced that are acceptable...
Yeah.
Then it is,
so in the 60s, being homosexual was considered deviant, and in some circles today, it's considered not socially acceptable to, you know, have facial piercings or to have tattoos, to engage in BDSM, things that aren't, you know, what you would call dinner table discussion. So what's really interesting for me is when you're looking at gender as a social norm, you can take the binary concept of gender, male and female, and you can subvert it through drag. Now, I don't know how many of you out there watch RuPaul's Drag Race, but I have never seen so many men apply Pritt Stick to their eyebrows and scrape their face back so hard and lip sync for their lives, because it's just so... when we're talking about gender expression, there's a difference between expressing your identity and being subversive.
Yes.
So... A drag, when someone is engaging in drag, so dressing up as the gender that they do not identify as, that is in no way, you can't conflate it with a trans person expressing their identity. They're completely different things, because drag is primarily a performance. It's a performance art. It is dressing up and putting styrofoam in your bum and wearing high heels and lots of glitter and wigs. That is not the same as being a trans woman, despite the fact that in both cases you are expressing yourself as a gender non-associated with the one you were assigned at birth. So what's really interesting is when we're talking about social norms, particularly in beauty, we do take a lot of our beauty cues from the drag scene. For example, I don't know how many of you tried to get those
eyebrows.
Gradiented eyebrows were a
they
drag thing.
From, yeah,
it the started drag in drag.
Beauty, yeah.
So it's really interesting, personally, to see how gender norms come from places of what would originally be considered deviancy and are... not, I don't want to say appropriated, but are assimilated into society or reclaimed by the people who may have opposed their very existence.
So what was considered queer and abnormal has now become perhaps normalised, because it's like we're taking it and we're saying, oh no, but it's okay to do it in this instance.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a never-ending circle of what was normal becomes strange and what's strange becomes normal.
That's a really powerful thing to remember, and I think particularly with I'm just going to go back for a little bit on the point that you raised about conflating drag and trans, and I think that there is such an extremely important distinction that needs to be made between, as you said rightfully, the notion of gender being performative versus the notion of gender being lived. And drag is a wonderfully subversive model, it's a wonderfully subversive act, which of course now has a wider mainstream appeal, particularly because of RuPaul's Drag Race, but because of how much it has now become part of, dare I say, mainstream pop culture, to use the term. But you know, it is in its essence, it is a subversive act. And I think what's particularly interesting is how transness is now, although it is generally accepted among liberal communities, certainly within the LGBTQ plus community itself and allies, that transness is a lived experience, it's still very interesting how the notion and the expression of transness is still such a subversive and politically charged environment.
Exactly. And even without... even if it's not in a trans way of experiencing life, the models of hypermasculinity and hyperfemininity and how they affect the experience that we live in our lives.
It's something that I've recently come across in the course of my PhD thesis. You know, when I'm not on radio, I actually get some work done.
Okay.
Potentially.
That's believable.
That's believable.
You
believe
that.
Me. You totally believe me. But I've been looking into kind of the influence of Western expectations on things like clothing and the current part of my thesis. And what was really interesting for me to see was how a lot of the silhouettes in South Asian culture are traditionally quite androgynous. And I don't mean, by androgynous, I don't mean everyone wears a suit and calls it androgynous. I mean, actually, the silhouette is...
Yeah.
Thank you. But the silhouette is actually universally androgynous for both men and women, and for non-binary individuals as well. Mm-hmm. But what was quite interesting was that that's now changed. And part of that is to do with our imperial legacy and to do with the history of being part of the British Empire. But much more largely and much more widely, there is this understanding which we raised about, you know, Western beauty standards of what we now like to refer to as feminine silhouette versus masculine silhouette. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to raise how it's considered really cool when someone like Scarlett Johansson does a photo shoot wearing a suit. Whereas when someone like Jaden Smith comes out wearing a dress, that automatically becomes a political statement rather than just being, oh, he looks nice in a dress. Or, you know, as Eddie Izzard said in an interview, I can't remember when this was, but, you know, he was asked in an interview, why do you have so many women's dresses? And he goes, they're not women's dresses, they're my dresses. I bought them, they're in my closet, they're my dresses. And this kind of double standard about women can wear what they want. The reason, but the underpinning of that being women can wear what they want because when they wear masculine clothes, it makes them better. Versus men can't wear feminine clothing. That's the thing. And that's something that really bothers me. Because there's this whole argument about, oh, you know, but women are allowed to wear whatever they want because they can wear suits. And I guess, but do you realise the reason they're allowed to do that is because literally you're saying feminine silhouettes, whatever that means, yes, is a negative thing.
And actually going, just to go off on another point related to that, did you guys ever get to see that... Zara, they did a new line of ungendered clothing.
Yes.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Instead of
so
using
by that, do you mean
the word
like
unisex, I suppose it's like an old term. Yeah, it's an old term. So unisex, you know, is referring to the binary sexes, so female and male. Whereas ungendered, I think it's more kind of ambiguous as to what they were trying to go for with that. Because really, all they did was take unisexual clothing that is typically, it actually just looks masculine, but androgynous, and just said, you know, if girls wear this, is fine.
It's not
ungendered, whereas no, they're just wearing masculine clothing.
I'm sorry, but like, I've seen the line. It's just boring clothing.
It is.
Like, I'm sorry.
T-shirts and jeans.
Genderless clothing to Zara might be just a vest and a pair of shorts, but genderless clothing is every item of clothing. Like, if you're a dude and you want to wear a dress, frickin' be a dude in a dress.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Your gender expression will not change your gender identity. So if you identify as a male... as a man, he, him, but you want to wear a dress or, you know, effeminize your look a little bit, that's fine because that's the way you present yourself.
Same goes for nail varnish and hair dye.
Now, just bearing in mind, of course, that in the context of this discussion and in the time limit of our show,
oh, yeah,
we haven't even touched on the fact of whether these concepts of masculinity and femininity are constructed anyway. Like, to me, the idea that nail polish is inherently feminine is in itself a problematic assumption to make. But even if we do take that as a starting off point, and bearing in mind that we do still live in a largely heteronormative society that does have certain standards, we disagree with them, but these standards do exist, a good starting point is, okay, you might think nail varnish is a feminine thing, I don't care.
Right, thank you very much for that. So we are coming to the end of the show. So things we've discussed about today: social norms, societal expectations, gender identity, gender expression, and gender and fashion, and you know, their relationships.